Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 25th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona. Today's obituaries includes the following names: Judith M. Amsden, Robert F. Benincasa, Olita Femme Bomer, Frank W. Cox, Nina Rose Fushi, Dr. Douglas Wayne Frericks, Doris Joan Gangelhoff, Marilyn Hazel Beck Holroyd, Linda Ann St. Pierre Hunt, Thomas Kenneth Irvine, Wallace Foster Jocelyn, Georgia Ann Q. Kilgore, Craig A. Linneman, Donald William May, known as Don, Deborah K. Nagorka, Wallace Perry, known as Wally, Audie J. Reynolds, Ruth Ellen Taylor Birkenkamp, Terrell G. Thomas, and Shirley Louise Williams. Sunsounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. And it looks like there are three articles on the page that has the economy listed. So for Arizona economy, the first article is Retailers Not Fans of Card Usage Fees. This was written by Betty Lynn Fisher for the USA Today. Heather Bernhardt is a small business owner, but she has a rant as a business owner and a customer. She cannot stand the growing practice of businesses charging consumers a surcharge to use their credit card. Bernhardt said in a TikTok post, quote, "Let me tell you, if you own a small store, you own a store, whatever, restaurant, and you charge me a surcharge for using a credit card, I am not coming back. Eat it. It's good customer service." Unquote. Well, Bernhardt's ire about credit card surcharges is not unique. In two separate national surveys of consumers, shoppers have said they are sick of being nickeled and dimed to pay a surcharge that used to be a cost of doing business. The practice of charging consumers a surcharge on transactions is allowed based on a 2012 settlement between credit card networks and a group of merchants in the United States. That's according to an article by WalletHub. And those surcharges can range anywhere from 1.5% to 3%. Well, the practice of passing along credit card transaction fees to consumers by adding a surcharge to their bill, it began showing up during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's when more consumers were moving to e-commerce and in-person businesses and restaurants were dealing with higher cost. That's according to John Kiernan, a WalletHub editor. However, the 2012 settlement only covered credit card transactions and not debit cards or prepaid gift cards. Visa and MasterCard rules prohibit transaction fees for debit card transactions, but enforcement is pretty lax since it is not a widely known, especially among smaller businesses and consumers. Kiernan told the USA Today, "For credit card transaction fees, the consumer is supposed to be notified in some manner before the transaction takes place. And if not, the consumer can file a dispute with the credit card issuer." Now, additionally, some states like Connecticut and Maine and Massachusetts, they have state laws that prohibit credit card surcharges for consumers. The credit card surcharge fee usage is widespread in practice and also causes widespread annoyance. In a recent study by WalletHub, 87% of people said, quote, "they are being nickel and dimed when they are asked to pay an extra fee for extra credit card payment processing, unquote. Well, more than 4 in 5 Americans said they were charged a fee for paying with a credit card, and 2 in 3 consumers said they would not use their credit card if they were charged a fee. More than 3 in 5 people also said they thought it was unfair for merchants to pass their payment processing fees on to their customers. Kiernan said the practice of adding the surcharge for credit card payments or offering a discount for cash, which is common at many gas stations, it has been growing in recent years. Once businesses started seeing that other companies were charging the surcharge without much backlash, then they started doing it as well. In a J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Merchant Services Satisfaction Study, which was released last January, 34% of merchants said they were adding surcharges for customer purchases made using credit cards. In the latest data from J.D. Power U.S. Credit Card Satisfaction Study, 82% of shoppers who said they faced a surcharge for using credit cards chose an alternative method of payment. John Cable, Managing Director for Payments Intelligence, said the survey did not ask whether any of those customers walked away from the transaction. Consumers don't like such add-ons, said Todd Rossman, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst. Ted said, quote, a surcharge is kind of a way to raise prices without raising prices, unquote. Now, while that may be legal, he added, quote, in the court of public opinion, most people would frown upon any sort of add-on, unquote. And consumers may complain to management or on social media, which is actually even worse because they're telling all their friends about this bad experience, he said. Most shoppers aren't carrying cash, and they're fighting both inflation and other rising costs, Rossman said. And businesses are also facing similar headwinds. Rossman said, quote, people feel like everything cost enough already, so businesses are looking to shift some of the cost burden onto the customer, unquote. Many customers are stuck paying the surcharge since they aren't carrying cash or they don't have a debit card. But some customers are pushing back. Bernhardt owns Blackbird Boutique in Marine City, Michigan. She sells women's clothing, gift items, and small home decor pieces. Bernhardt said it's hard enough to compete as a small business owner, and she wants to please her customers. She does not tack on a credit card surcharge. But she was mad enough recently after visiting another store that charged her to use her debit card that she put her rant on TikTok. And in her video, Bernhardt said business should either eat the cost or, quote, bake it in, unquote, to the price of the goods, which she doesn't do. She said such surcharges are bad for business. And then she said, quote, you've probably lost a customer, and you're not getting that returning customer and future sales, unquote. So if more consumers are having to pay surcharges, is it worth using a credit card to earn cashback rewards or other perks? Rossman said consumers should weigh how much they're paying in a surcharge versus what they're earning in rewards. Consumers should also pay their credit card bill each month to avoid paying extra interest fees. But credit cards do offer extra perks, such as extended warranties and purchase protection or travel insurance. So that's something to think about as well. Consumers can also get ahead by picking the right credit card. Use those cards for your common purchases. Then, even if you get charged the surcharge, you're still coming out ahead. You won't come out ahead on all transactions, since the surcharge may be more than what you are earning in rewards. But there are credit cards that also give you initial points or cash back bonuses. Kiernan said, quote, if you're making a bunch of small purchases, even if they have a small surcharge added on, if you're saving $1,000 at the end of the day, it's still coming out way ahead, unquote. Some consumers will use multiple cards, debit cards, or store credit cards, which may offer better rewards or incentives, Kiernan said. Some consumers may opt to do automatic payments via their bank account or link their checking account to a retailer or business account to get a discount, he said. Kiernan suggests having a credit card with good rewards and then having a debit card on hand for the times when a retailer wants to charge a surcharge for the credit card. And that was retailers, not fans of card usage fees. Our next article from the economy section. Costco tightens buying limits for its gold bars. Written by Mike Snyder for the USA Today. Gold has become such a hot commodity that Costco is apparently limiting how much its members can buy. The warehouse retailer began selling 24-karat gold bars to its members in 2023. The limit was 2 bars per person. But now that limit has changed to 1 per transaction and a maximum of 2 bars per 24 hours when you look at the retailer website. The price tag for a 1-ounce South African-made gold bar, $3,279.99. That's much higher than the $2,000 that they were going for 19 months ago, shortly after Costco began selling them. However, that price increase is understandable, as gold prices have risen more than 70% over that time, hitting record highs in April. Another listing for the 1-ounce gold bar PAMP Swiss Lady Fortuna Veriscan limits members to 1 item per transaction and a maximum of 2 items per 24 hours. That was down from a limit of 5 items per 24 hours back in January. The same product had a cap of 2 purchases per membership back in September of 23, according to an archived snapshot of the listing. The retailer also has limits on other precious metals, include the 1-ounce American Eagle gold coin, $3,329.99, 1 per transaction and 2 transactions per 24 hours. The 10-ounce silver bar, $359.99, 1 per transaction and 10 per 24 hours. One option without a limit is the smaller 5-gram gold bar. It's on an 18-karat gold chain. It's priced at $1,149.99. Now, Costco did not respond to a request for a comment from USA Today. The gold bars constantly sold out when they were first available online in 2023. Costco's then chief financial officer, Richard Galante, told analysts during the company's earnings call in September of 2023, quote, "When we load them on the site, they're typically gone within a few hours, and we limit 2 per member," unquote. Now, sales of gold and other categories, including jewelry, were up double digits in the 24-week period ending February 16th, according to Chief Financial Officer Gary Millerchip. The retailer also began selling silver Canadian coins in March of 2024. Costco could be making $100 million to $200 million a month by selling gold bars. That's an estimate from Wells Fargo Equity Research made in April of 2024. If the gold prices remain high and economic uncertainty continues, the bars could remain popular purchases. One social media user quipped this, quote, "You know, things are getting weird when your mom starts eyeing gold bars at Costco like it's toilet paper in 2020, unquote. And that was the article, Costco Tightens Buying Limits for Its Gold Bars. The third article from the economy section, Buc-ee's Opening New Stores in Several States, by James Powell for the USA Today. In some parts of the country, the next time a driver sees a beaver on the road, it might just be offering up some pulled pork sandwiches, and a refill on gas. Bucky's continues to expand its footprint of gargantuan gas stations with locations slated to open across the country. The brand has created a cult-like following centered around its clean restrooms and its above-average culinary offerings. Founded back in 1982, the Texas-based company has quickly become one of the state's most recognized exports. It opened its first location west of Texas in Johnstown, Colorado in 2024, and is in the process of building its first location in the Southwest. The company prides itself on its outsized stores. Its largest location, at 75,000 square feet, was opened last year in Luling, Texas. Now, the company's website lists three locations with opening dates this year: Harrison County, Mississippi, Brunswick, Georgia, and Rockingham County, Virginia. A fourth site is slated for next year in Bourne, Texas. The Arizona Republic, which is a part of the USA Today network, reported that the state's first Bucky's, which broke ground May 14th, is scheduled to open in June 2026 in the Phoenix suburb of Goodyear. The Savannah Morning News, which is also part of the USA Today network, reported that the Bucky's in Brunswick, Georgia, is set to open on July 1st. The paper also reported that Georgia's fourth Bucky's is being built in Monroe County and is set to open in early 2026. The company plans to open its Huber Heights, Ohio location in April 2026. Bucky's spokesperson, Chrissy Gonzalez, told the Cincinnati Enquirer, part of the USA Today network. Now, a location in southwestern Florida is under consideration as a part of a trio of villages in Harborview. That was reported by the Fort Myers News Press. A location in Ocala, Florida, broke ground in February, though no opening date has been set. That's according to Fox 35 Orlando. And the Charlotte Observer reported that a location in Mabane, North Carolina, is targeted for an opening in late 2026 or early 2027. And that was the article, Bucky's Opening New Stores in Several States. We're coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section now. Well, the cover story from the front page of the sports section was an article written by Greg Moore, who's a columnist for the Arizona Republic. And it's titled, Bitter Cards Fans Accuse Harrison of Lacking Greatness. But he's written the article as kind of a made-for-TV courtroom appearance. So here's what he wrote in the article. We've got to make the playoffs, is a quote that Harrison said on May 19th, speaking to reporters at the Cardinals headquarters in Tempe. He went on and said, this is the year. We have all the pieces we need. We just have to go out there and execute. They brought me here to help this team win games. So, improving to me means we win more games than we won last year. Unquote. All rise. This court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Gregory G. Moore, Jr. presiding. You may now be seated. Judge Moore says, let's start with the plaintiffs. The bitter Cardinal fans say, Your Honor, Marvin Harrison, Jr. has been a disappointment. He was the first player selected after quarterbacks went 1-2-3 in the 2024 draft. He was taken ahead of Malik Nabers, Brian Thomas, and Ladd McConkey, all of whom had more catches and yards than Harrison. Harrison is just the latest first-round disappointment we have had to put up with. Marvin Harrison supporters said, Your Honor, we object. Josh Rosen, Robert Nkemdichie, and Isaiah Simmons have no relevance here. Judge Moore says, objection sustained. Although Darius Robinson isn't doing order in the court, So you can cue the dramatic music of the daytime courtroom TV show like People's Court or Judge Judy. Well, the plaintiffs, the bitter Arizona Cardinals fans who are convinced nothing good can happen to them, they watch the defendant, Marvin Harrison Jr., make 62 catches for 885 yards and 8 touchdowns as a rookie. But they think Maserati Marv has turned out to be a lemon. Judge Moore says, defendants, let's hear from you. What do you have to say? And Marvin Harrison's supporters said, Your Honor, our client is being held to an unreasonable standard. This franchise has not had a 1,000-yard wide receiver since DeAndre Hopkins in 2020. Judge Moore says, Well, what about Trey McBride? And Marvin Harrison's supporter said, He's a tight end, Your Honor, and we'll have more on him later. So Judge Moore says, Carry on. Marvin Harrison's supporters say, Judge, our client had a better rookie season than Larry Fitzgerald and a nearly identical rookie season to his Hall of Fame father, Marvin Harrison Sr. Judge Moore says, Okay, back to the plaintiffs. Prove your case. And the bitter Cardinals fans said, Fitzgerald? Harrison Sr., Your Honor, it was a totally different NFL in those days. You have to adjust those two totals for rule change inflation. One receiving yard back then was like 2 or 3 yards today. Marvin Harrison's supporters yelled, Objection! Speculation! And Judge Moore said, I'll allow it, but tread carefully, plaintiffs. And the bitter Cardinals fans say, Your Honor, the pro football world is trying to act like Ohio State is wide receiver university. But has anyone been paying attention to what's happening at LSU? Jamar Chase, Justin Jefferson, Brian Thomas, Malik Nabers. Why can't Harrison be more like these guys? And he's not even the best of the Buckeyes. Wouldn't you rather have Garrett Wilson or Jackson Smith Njigba or a healthy Chris Olave? We need a true number one wide receiver for Kyler Murray, and Marvin Harrison Jr. isn't up to it. Judge Moore says, Okay, let's hear from the defendants. And let me just say for the record that another Buckeye receiver, San Antonio Holmes, was out of bounds in the 2009 Super Bowl. Marvin Harrison's supporters say, Your Honor, our client would like to speak to the wide receiver you controversy. Judge Moore says, Okay, Mr. Harrison, you're already sworn in. The court will hear from you now. So Marvin Harrison Jr. says, Everyone wants the title of wide receiver U. LSU has some amazing guys on their end, but we've got some amazing guys on our end, too. Obviously, I'm going to always be biased and say Ohio State is wide receiver U, but they definitely have a good argument. Judge Moore says, Well, thank you, Mr. Harrison. Humility will serve you well in life. I'm not sure how that will translate in my courtroom, but carry on, defendants. Marvin Harrison's supporters, Your Honor, we're simply asking for time and some reasonable expectations. We would like to start with the example of Marvin Harrison Sr. It took him until year 4 to crack 1,000 yards. Dad's first 2 years that he played with Jim Harbaugh and Paul Justin. We're sure Paul Justin was a fine player, not to mention a fine Arizona State Sun Devil quarterback, but in year 3, Dad had rookie Peyton Manning, who threw 28 interceptions. Jameis Winston and Vinny Testaverde think Manning was wild that year. And year 4, it all clicked. Also, consider Trey McBride. He did not break out until year 3, and now he's one of the best players in the sport. Marvin Harrison Jr.'s rookie numbers are pretty similar to Drake London and Amon-Ra St. Brown, and no one is questioning their number one status. Judge Moore says, Okay, I've heard of enough. Mr. Harrison, step forward, please. I've got an additional question for you. Last season, your jersey was not available in the team shop over a legal dispute that's been resolved. Fans will now be able to wear your jersey to games. What does that mean to you? And Marvin Harrison Jr. said, I'm glad we got that situated and people can wear the 18 jersey. It's always amazing to see people support you, especially little kids. It definitely means a lot. And Judge Moore says, Well, thank you, Mr. Harrison. I'm ready to rule. In the case of the Haters versus Harrison, I find that the plaintiffs are being unreasonable in calling for Maserati Marv to take a back seat to Keenan Allen, Amari Cooper, or anyone else. If Cardinals general manager Monty Ossenfort thinks a veteran presence will free Harrison up by attracting attention from safeties and preventing Harrison from being double covered, by all means, he should go get Allen at a reasonable price. But no one should be calling for Harrison to take a diminished role in the offense. That's just ridiculous. Marvin Harrison Jr. is definitely a number one receiver on a playoff team. He just needs a little more time to get established. And then the gavel is banged on the counter, and the judge says, "This court is adjourned." And that was the article by Greg Moore entitled "Bitter Cards Fans Accuse Harrison of Lacking Greatness." We'll turn the front page of the sports section over and take a look inside the sports section. Well, here's an article written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. Phoenix Open announces record charity donations. For the Phoenix Open, another year brought another record-setting donation to charity. This year's total contributions reached $18.1 million, announced this week by the Thunderbirds, who organized the annual PGA Tour stop. The previous high was $17.5 million set last year. Outside of the two events that were affected by COVID-19 back in 2021 and 2022, the total donations have increased every year since 2016, when donations remained steady. The last non-pandemic tournament in which donations decreased was way back in 2011. Now, according to the Thunderbirds, those donations support local nonprofits, quote, with a focus on youth, education, and families in need, unquote. The organization made this year's announcement at Child Crisis Arizona, a group that provides emergency shelter, foster care, adoption, and other services for at-risk children. Tournament chairman Matt Mooney said, quote, "The community supports the Phoenix Open, and then the Thunderbirds are able to turn around and be the stewards of giving that money back to the community and making an impact on those in need. So that is the driving force for us as an organization," unquote. Now, the 2025 tournament brought a real risk of a setback. The 2024 event descended into chaos. It had inclement weather turning much of the course into a mud pit. There was overcrowding, and record arrest followed. Fans and players threatened to stay away without major changes. So, last spring, the Thunderbirds organized a series of meetings, not just with PGA players and executives, but also with their key corporate sponsors. And together, they formulated a plan to retain the tournament's signature energy without sacrificing safety. They raised ticket prices, they added a second entrance, and they widened the fan walkways, among other changes. By the time that this year's tournament arrived in February, Mooney was confident, at least publicly, in the ability to match previous fundraising tallies. He said, quote, "We weren't concerned, just because we really felt like we were able to diagnose immediately the challenges of 2024 and where we could do better in 2025. We felt like as long as we focused on the fan experience and the player experience, we were going to find ourselves in a really good position," unquote. Throughout the week of the tournament, the Thunderbirds saw their changes pay off, with positive feedback from players and fans. And this week, they saw them pay off with $18.1 million in charitable donations. And that was the article, "Phoenix Open Announces Record Charity Donations." Our next article is entitled "Fireworks, Bobbleheads Arrive versus Pirates and Gnats." This was by Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. The Arizona Diamondbacks wrap up a six-game road trip on May 25th at St. Louis against the Cardinals, and then it's back home to play the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Washington Nationals May 26, 27, 28, and May 30th through June 1st. Brandon Pfaadt aims for his 8th win of the season when he gets the start for the Diamondbacks at Busch Stadium. The homestand features a fireworks night, as well as a City Connect bobblehead giveaway. Now the Pirates are at the bottom of the NL Central standings and have made a managerial change, firing Derek Shelton earlier in May, after he started the season with a 12-26 record. The Pirates had a 7-game losing streak from May 1st to 7th. Despite having one of baseball's most electric pitchers, right-hander Paul Skenes, and a rising talent in the athletic O'Neill Cruz, the Pirates have not been able to win much. Pittsburgh has not won a series at Chase Field since 2016. The Nationals and the Diamondbacks have already played a series against each other, April 4th through the 6th in Washington, D.C. The Diamondbacks lost 2 of the 3, both of those defeats by just 1 run, and they lost star second baseman Ketel Marte to a hamstring injury for what would all be almost a month. The Nationals have found a talent in the 22-year-old outfielder, James Wood, who, as of May 22nd, led the team in hits, doubles, and home runs. He and starting pitcher Mackenzie Gore are players to watch for Washington. So, special events at Chase Field this week include a Memorial Day Red Poppy Cap giveaway on May 26th to the first 20,000 fans through the gates, post-game fireworks on May 30th, and a Geraldo Perdomo City Connect bobblehead giveaway on May 31st. And that was the article, Fireworks and Bobbleheads Arrive versus Pirates and Nats. Well, we're coming up on 32 minutes past the hour, so we need to move on over to the opinion section and read some opinions. Our first opinion piece was written by Elvia Diaz, who is a columnist for the Arizona Republic. If feds won't hold sheriff accountable, who will? The notion that we must end court supervision of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office just because it cost too much isn't just absurd. It's opportunistic politics. Thomas Galvin, the chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, has expressed frustration over the staggering sums spent annually on court-mandated reforms aimed at eliminating racial profiling of Latinos and addressing internal affairs issues. This week, the county approved $34 million for that purpose, and it estimates the total cost will reach $352 million by next year. That's nearly 12 years after a federal court determined that then-Sheriff Joe Arpaio unlawfully targeted migrants. Well, that's a lot of money, and Gavin is right to ask why taxpayers should keep footing the bill for Arpaio's misconduct. But instead of focusing on why the sheriff's office remains out of court compliance, after so much spent over such a long time period of time, he is disappointingly playing into Trump's disdain for judges to end it all. Galvin wrote in a letter to Trump's Attorney General, Pam Bondi, quote, "Tragically, one of the largest obstacles to protecting our citizens is legal. Judicial takeovers of law enforcement through consent decrees and court-appointed monitors and judgments that mutate over time to prevent local governments from ever satisfying their requirements and regaining local control." He added, "These judgments are an assault on federalism and a quiet tyranny carried out by activist federal judges and their political allies." Unquote. Well, that kind of language is right up Trump and MAGA's alley to fight court rulings against them. And now Galvin is targeting the judge instead of demanding accountability from the sheriff's office. Well, how did we get here? 2 decades ago, Arpaio carried out highly publicized immigration sweeps, large-scale traffic patrols targeting migrants. In 2007, Manuel de Jesus Ortega Melendrez sued him. And in 2013, a federal judge found that Arpaio had violated the constitutional rights of Latinos, racially profiling them and conducting unlawful traffic stops, and thus he imposed overhauls. So 3 years later, and millions of dollars spent, county residents had had enough of the Republican Arpaio, voting him out and electing Democrat Paul Pinzone. Well, soon after leaving office, Arpaio was convicted of criminal contempt of court because he kept detaining suspected undocumented immigrants, defying court orders. He escaped jail only because his pal, President Trump, pardoned him. Pinzone undid many of Arpaio's most infamous policies and gained the trust of many Latinos. But in 2022, Pinzone himself faced a civil contempt verdict because he took too long to close investigations into staff misconduct. The caseload had then grown to more than 2,000, and it took an average of nearly 2 years to close each case. The backlog grew because of court-mandated reforms, which included setting up a community panel and investigating staff wrongdoing. So in 2023, after 7 years as sheriff, Pinzone called it quits, expressing frustration over the federal oversight. The county appointed Pinzone's deputy, Russ Skinner, who had been with MCSO since 1990. But last November, the sheriff's office came full circle when voters elected Arpaio's right-hand man, Jerry Sheridan, as sheriff. Sheridan himself was found in civil contempt of court while working for Arpaio over the long-running Melendrez racial profiling case. The jury, figuratively and literally, is still out over what kind of sheriff Sheridan will be. But don't expect him to like federal oversight of the department that he and his former boss, Arpaio, turned into a reality TV show at Latino's expense. Now, a lot has changed since Arpaio left office. The most recent court-mandated annual report covering traffic stops in 2023 indicates that there are no statistical disparities between Hispanic and white drivers. Additionally, no disparities were identified between black and white drivers who were pulled over. So why then is the sheriff's office still under court supervision? Well, that's a good question. Galvin put this quote on X, quote, "Say what you will about the original lawsuit, I don't understand the justification of why a federal monitor is saying the board has to appropriate $34 million in compliance cost," unquote. Now, Galvin may have a point that the goalposts keep moving, but I disagree with his assertion that the court-appointed monitor just wants to keep his lucrative gig, implying that the $352 million has either been pocketed or a total waste. The question is, why has it taken $352 million and years of federal oversight to stop the sheriff of Arizona's most populous county from racially profiling its residents? What would have happened without federal oversight? You know, I get the sheriff's frustration and the annoyance of having to deal with the courts, and I certainly understand how taxpayers are fed up with footing the bill. But does anyone really trust that the sheriff, the same one who stood by Joe Arpaio during his darkest days, will implement necessary changes without judicial oversight? Is there confidence that any individual, including the well-meaning Galvin, would ensure accountability in the sheriff's office, particularly when they have MAGA on their side? Well, the answer to both questions is no. So, is court oversight perfect? Absolutely not. And is it the only way? No. But unfortunately, history has taught us that the courts have often been the only tool to seek justice against the quiet, not-so-quiet tyranny against minorities. And that was Elvia Diaz's column, "If Feds Won't Hold Sheriff Accountable, Who Will?" Our next opinion piece is written by Stephen Richer, a guest columnist, and it's entitled, "Heap May Have Dug His Own Hole, But I Still Feel for Him." Justin Heap beat me in the 2024 Republican primary, and he replaced me as Maricopa County Recorder. I'm now writing in his defense, kind of. In just a few weeks in office, Heap has seemingly managed to aggravate every elected Republican in Maricopa County. County Chairman Thomas Galvin recently wrote on X, quote, "We won't let Justin Heap set a bad precedent of bad election ideas," unquote. Supervisor Debbie Lesko fired off a number of criticisms of Heap, calling some of Heap's actions misguided, illegal, and expressing her frustration with Heap's manner of negotiating. County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, also a Republican, took Heap's office to task for lying about attorney advice. Mitchell also pointed out that Heap's proposed actions, quote, "would be in excess of his legal authority," unquote, and she would not be able to defend him. Well, even the Arizona Republican Party expressed its unqualified opposition to Heap on one front and pointed out Heap's apparent misunderstanding of Arizona law and its potential to undermine the AZGOP's recent victories for election integrity. Wow, all of this before Heap even completed administering his first election earlier this week. Some of these less than flattering comments resulted from Heap's recent head-scratching proposal to send mail ballots to voters who hadn't requested them. That's against the law. A similar proposal tripped up Secretary of State Adrian Fontes in March 2020 when he was Maricopa County Recorder. At that time, Arizona Republican columnist Lori Roberts wrote on these very pages that, quote, "Adrian Fontes is making up election law as he goes along. This won't end well," unquote. But some of the animus between Heap and his fellow county electeds arise from Arizona's arcane state law that splits election management responsibilities between the County Board of Supervisors and the Recorder. Here, Heap has my sympathy. This legal setup is dumb. I've been saying so since January of 2023. Even under the best of circumstances, it creates an unwieldy operation that wastes resources, confuses voters, frustrates administrators. It puts multiple independently elected cooks in the administrative kitchen. As an example, Arizona law assigns in-person early voting to the Recorder, but in-person election day voting to the Board of Supervisors. Now, both operations require the same election equipment for 100-plus voting locations. That includes voting booths, check-in computers, ballot printers, and vote-here signs, as well as hundreds of temporary workers doing the same work. Some small counties simply duplicate the resources. They buy separate sets of all the equipment, one set for the Recorder, one set for the Board of Supervisors. And this is a small waste in small counties. But in Maricopa County, this waste would amount to millions of dollars. Assistant County Manager Zach Shira recently estimated this waste at between $11 million and $13 million in one-time cost and $1.8 million in ongoing cost. Supervisor Steve Gallardo called such a step an injustice to Maricopa County residents. The Recorder and the Board of Supervisors also could share the same equipment and personnel. But who calls the shots on how to prepare the equipment, and how to test the equipment, and how to store the equipment, where to send the equipment, whom to hire, and how to train those temporary workers? See, it's messy. In the legislative arena, this type of cooperative tension is potentially good. It does create compromise. But when it comes to administration of the law, it is awful. It's like having two CEOs. It's why no other state divides election administration between two independently elected political bodies. It's why no other county office pairing in Arizona is subject to this lunacy. Can you imagine if County Attorney Rachel Mitchell had to share prosecutorial responsibilities with the Board of Supervisors? If Mitchell's personnel would handle all pretrial parts of the prosecution, but then the board's attorneys would take over for the trial? See, it's easy to see just how silly that would be. and yet that's what the law requires in the election context. During my time in office, the Board of Supervisors and I created multiple agreements to smooth over some of the statutory awkwardness. Even so, it was occasionally very tough, and it only worked because of the philosophical alignment and the friendships between the five board members and me. But, as is evident now with HEAP, and has been on display in recent years in Pinal County and Cochise County, such alignment between the recorder and the board is not guaranteed. It's why the state legislature needs to follow the lead of the 49 other states and vest all county election responsibilities in one elected body. I strongly suggest, as I did in January 2023, putting it all under the Board of Supervisors. It is a multi-member body, so no one person will be in charge of elections. It is subject to public meeting laws. It is likely to reflect some level of bipartisanship. And it is unlikely to swing dramatically from election cycle to election cycle. Justin Heap seems like a challenging person to work with under the best circumstances. But part of the current friction comes from a poorly designed system. We should revisit that system's design. And that is Stephen Richards' guest column, "Heap May Have Dug His Own Hole, But I Still Feel for Him." At 47 minutes past the hour, it's time for us to move on to the entertainment section. We begin by reading today's horoscopes. We begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Prepare for an influx of activity. You desire mental quest and spontaneous outings. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, fluctuating income becomes a thing, so get clever. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, first impressions are everything. How do you want to express yourself? Freshen your impact. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, inner reflection is encouraged. Process the past for insight. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, share and expand ideas in a group dynamic. Social networking increases. For you fellow Virgos out there with birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, your word stretches far and wide. What you say is put in the limelight. So, make a statement. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, a restless mind needs stimulation. Find ways to pair study and adventure. Seek out experience. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, what you focus on grows. Check your thoughts. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, conversation is the backbone of a functioning partnership. Pick the minds of your loved ones. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, mental efficiency can streamline your routines. Concoct clever ways to improve your productivity. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, your mind wants to play. Seek entertainment. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Do you need to make decisions around home and family? Well, Mercury in Gemini delivers the right information and conversations to do so. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I've been divorced for 10 years and have since remarried. I began dating my current wife 9 years ago. I have 4 daughters, ages 24 through 37. Since the divorce, our relationships have been strained because my ex continues to hold them emotionally hostage by feeding her narrative that I'm the bad guy for initiating the divorce. Because my daughters seem to believe everything their mother tells them, it's been difficult to reintegrate back into their lives because they don't know what to believe or who to trust. My new wife gets frustrated when they don't call me for the big events like birthdays and Father's Day and holidays, etc. And I feel horrible because her kids make a point of contacting me for every event. Should I continue accepting where things are with my daughters and wait for them to realize I'm not the monster their mother has painted me as? Or should I try having a hard conversation with each of them and take my chances on possibly saying the wrong thing and making things worse? Signed, Damned If I Do or Don't. And Abby responds, Dear Damned, I'm not sure what the circumstances were that made you divorce their mother, but your daughters are no longer children. They are fully into adulthood. I do think a conversation with each of them is in order. If you approach the subject saying that things don't always work out as planned, and had you found living with their mother to be tolerable, you would still be married, it might make the rest of what you have to say more palatable. If your ex has accused you of infidelity, you have a right to defend yourself as long as you don't assassinate their mother's character, which is likely what she has done to yours. Our next letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I am the youngest of four sisters. I lost one of them, Rachel, to cancer several years ago. She and I were considered the failures of the family because we had to work hard to take care of our families, whereas our other two sisters married into money. Rachel did not take part in many family get-togethers because, I'm guessing, she felt out of place. I didn't understand it then, but I do now that she's gone because I feel the same way. It's aggravating for me now when my sisters come to town. They don't understand how hard we have to work to get by. They think we and our children, who are out working hard too, can take time off any time to get together with them when they come on short notice. It's aggravating, and I'm unsure how to approach this. Please help. Signed, Failure in Florida. And Abby responds, Dear Failure, your successful sisters appear to be annoyingly obtuse. The next time you receive an invitation on short notice, patiently explain to them the difference in your lifestyle and theirs, and point out that it precludes you changing your schedule at the drop of a hat. Then tell them the amount of time you need to prepare, why you would want to get together with anyone who makes you feel less than puzzles me. And that's with the two letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. You can contact her by going to her website, www.dearabby.com. Now it's time for some comics. In the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, in the first frame, General Halftrack is sitting at his desk, and he looks at his calendar and he says, "Ooh, I don't seem to have anything on my calendar." In the next frame, he stands in the door to his office and says to his secretary, "I don't have any appointments today?" And his secretary says, "No, sir." And he says, the next frame, he says, "Well, that doesn't seem right." And then the secretary says, "Well, do you want me to set some up?" And he goes, "Yes, I can't waste my time all day." So he goes back in, sets at his desk, and she comes in and gives him his calendar. And he looks at it and says, haircut, manicure, tea time, massage, officers' club. Well, that's more like it. And that was Beetle Bailey. And in the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dagwood and Blondie are in their bed. Dagwood's propped up on his pillow. He goes, sigh. She looks like she's about to sleep. And then he goes, "It's hopeless." And then she finally rolls over and looks at him and says, "This insomnia is driving me crazy tonight." And so she says to him, "Why don't you get up and go do some boring chores?" He goes, "Great idea, honey." And he jumps out of bed in the next frame. Oh, and in the last frame, he says, "I'll start by decluttering the fridge." And he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 items stacked up, 4 on each arm and in each hand. And looks like he's preparing to eat. Anyway, that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Scott and Jerry Kirkman, maybe it's Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first frame, Dad is given a piggyback ride to Little Wren. "Giddy up, giddy up, giddy up," she yells. And Hammy sees him, and he yells, "Me too." And so now Hammy and Wren are on Dad's back. "Giddy up, giddy up, ride 'em, cowboy." And now Zoe sees, and she goes, "Make room for me." So now all three kids are piled on Dad's back. "Giddy up, ride 'em, cowboy, yee-haw." Dad looks like he's starting to sweat. And then he stops and says, "Okay, that's enough for now, guys." And the kids climb off and go, "Thanks, Dad." In the last frame, Dad is laying down on the bed, face down. And he says, "I may just need to be put out to stud," as his wife Wanda is massaging his aching back. And she says, "We'll call that Plan Z." And that was Baby Blues. Well, let's wish some celebrities a happy birthday. Who is celebrating today? The actor Ian McKellen turns 86 today. Leslie Uggams turns 82. The puppeteer and actor Frank Oz turns 81. Karen Valentine turns 78. Mike Myers turns 62. Octavia Spencer turns 55. And Cillian Murphy turns 49. Congratulations and happy birthday to all of them. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 25th, 2025. I hope you have a great day today. Bye-bye.